Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. And each week on this program, I bring out people who I feel are really at the cutting edge of a evolution, a revolution, evolvement, an upliftment of consciousness that's happening in this country and around the world. And tonight I have one of the grand masters of this movement. She's been an inspiration to thousands, maybe millions around the world, and she's right at the cutting edge of consciousness. And it's her dedication and what she's created in her life that is bringing that awareness, that conscious awareness, to other people. I'm welcoming tonight Jean Houston. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you for that kind introduction.
Yes, and you know what's so amazing? Because what you're speaking about is how to discover our potential, how to discover who we really are in our own lives. I mean, you have a teleseminar coming up that people can then use the tools you've discovered throughout your life to bring out their potential. And you know, the amazing thing is I just came from a movie screening called Discover the Gift. Have you heard about that film?
What is the name of it, Ellen? Discover?
It's called Discover the Gift.
And, no, I have heard about it. I hear it's very interesting.
It's a beautiful film, but I think what you're giving people, it's a great film to inspire people, but what I feel you're giving people, because I listened to some of your talk about this, is practical tools to discover that divine potential within. So, you know, what I would like to talk to you about today is, yes, how do you inspire that? I'd like to talk about how, what I need to work on, but I also am interested in your thought processes, how you look at the world and how it's somehow different than the people who've just been given a routine in life. There's something was created at a young age, and I know you tell those stories, but where you looked at the world differently. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, thank you. I've never been asked that. That's a wonderful question. Well, one of the reasons I look at the world differently is because I've been in so many parts of it, you know, not just the outer world, but the inner world as well. In terms of the outer world, I've worked in, the last count was 107 countries and 40 cultures intensely over the last 50 years. And this work, whether I was working with UNICEF or the United Nations Development Program or the Institute of Cultural Affairs or on my own, gave me a perspective on human greatness and human difference that is just extraordinary. You know, that we, as a species, you know, when we decide to leave our cultural trance and stop being encapsulated bags of skin dragging around a dreary little ego, when we really begin to explore the depth and breadth of who and what we are, and I've had the blessing, Alan, to really have firsthand, you know, front row seats on the emergence of the new human being, well, then we have hope. I'm one of the few people I know who really has hope. People say, how dare you have hope with so many problems? And I agree about the problems, but I say I have hope because I have the experience to have seen so many different cultures, to see the genius of how the Balinese become train everyone to be an artist by communing and becoming one with the art form, of seeing how a tribe in West Africa has no war and has no neurosis as we understand it, because they solve problems differently. They say the problem with sanitation, this is a tribe related to the Yoruba in West Africa, and they dance the problem, and they sing it, and they drum it, and they become it, and they draw it, and they incarnate it, and by God, they get the solution because they're cooking on more burners. You know, well, after you've been studying all these different human capacities and then trying to bring them back to different, you know, people and UN agencies, etc., you really have a sense that we are not going to die out, that we are in a point of what is called technically speciation, which means we're rising to a new order of our own species. And that, you know, so I, to have that blessing in the outer world and then in the inner world to have been given the chance to make depth probings of the human psyche through well, whatever way I did it, you know, through activation of creative states, through trance, through hypnosis, through active imagination, through tapping into the sensory, the psychological, the mythic, the spiritual realms that we all contain, and to see the abundance, or as my Sicilian grandmother would say, the abbondanza, the sheer abbondanza of complexity and capacity that we all contain, and then learning how to evoke that capacity. So I would say that to bring this outer world that I've been exposed to for so many decades, and then the inner world as well, that has given me a perspective on greatness and on possibility that does not allow me to be skeptical or downhearted about who we are and where we're going.
I really appreciate that perspective, because I never gave up any hope either, and I know there's a bright, shining future awaiting for all of us who discover who we are. I mean, life has given us this gift so we can fulfill our potential, and then there are midwives like you who are bringing out that potential in a latent humanity. So as we move into this next speciesization, this new species, what does it look like to you? What does the new world radiate to your creative mind?
I think one of the things it radiates is a planetary civilization with a high development of individual culture. Not a homogenization. In fact, I think we're moving further and further away from homogenization as the corporate main structures are beginning to break down, as they are all over the world. I mean, that's the news that doesn't make the news, you know. I think that we are moving into a situation where obviously banking is going to have to change. You can't have 1% of the population in America owning more than the rest of the 90%. I mean, that's just wrong and evil. I think we're moving into a place where there is a great, both, as I say, individuation of culture, but also a fusion. Now, I'm not talking about that restaurant in San Francisco, which is Jewish and Chinese, called the Genghis Cohen. You know, I'm talking about the nature of the world music, the world psychology, the world arts, you know, it's as if the planet herself is birthing a whole new modalities and ways of being, in which we realize that we are stewards of the planet. You know, I had something to do with helping in some NASA situations, helping astronauts, particularly one, remember what he saw on the moon, and that was Edgar Mitchell particularly. And he, you know, I tried all sorts of things, you know, active imagination, trance, yelling at them. Yelling is what worked, especially. And finally, Edgar Mitchell said, "Gee, you're asking the wrong question. It's not what we saw on the moon. It's what we saw coming back to Earth. Because coming back to Earth, there she was, our beautiful blue and silver planet, you know, floating in the womb of the cosmos." And he said, "And there were no wars. And there was no, you know, there was no antagonism." And he said, "I felt such nostalgia for what the world could be. I went up there an astronaut. I came back a psychonaut, devoted to developing inner space so that we would be adequate stewards." And I think that's where we are, don't you think so? That we are at that place of either grow or die, evolve or perish, become the stewards or become the destroyers.
Well, yeah, we are absolutely at the final hour, and why are people not getting that? Why is there an unconscious government, military control? Why are there still wars? Why are we running out of resources, and the rich still want to keep what they can for themselves? I mean, I really don't understand it, and I mean, maybe we're doing everything we can do, but why? Why does it have to come down? And maybe it does. Maybe it has to come down to the very last moment in time where we'll either make it or not. I mean, it's changing for us, but there's a whole world out there who has no idea. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes. Well, and there's a whole world out there that does have an idea, you know. Are you going to look at half empty or half full? I think we're in final days. You know, it's like what they say when the bar is closing. It's closing time, but it's also the beginning of the opening time, the sunset effect. The sun blares out in brilliant colors before it sinks across below the horizon. And I think we're seeing the sunset effect of old orders that have been in existence, some for 2,000, 3,000 years, some for 300 years, some for the last 50 years. And as this is happening, a lot of people are waking up and feeling the rumblings beneath the surface crust of consciousness. You know, the hound of heaven going rah, 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 at our feet in the morning, saying, "It's time to wake up. It is time to wake up." So that, yes, the official media, the out there, the kosher media, the cultural trance says it's all going to hell in a handbasket. And we are suffering the necessary cataclysms, but those cataclysms cause us then to release the old structures, release the old habits, to begin to seek, to have programs like yours, to have, you know, seminars and explorations and research like mine that allow us to really activate and ignite the new potentials that are absolutely required if we are going to, if we're going to survive and enhance upon our world. And cataclysm always precedes new emergence, new synergy, new transmutation, always.
Right. Of course, there's the obstacle or opportunity metaphor that the Chinese have. But, you know, I call my program New Realities because I feel, yeah, we have these, we do have the solutions. We have the technological, we have the know-how to make change. But what needs to happen is a new way of thinking about who we are and yes, the global situation, our connections to each other. And this might, question might come out of left field, but you know who I think was so much a leader in that was your husband, Robert Masters, because he allowed a level of consciousness to come into him that was so foreign and so different, yet he accepted it in the vast mind that he was. Could you talk about him and what he allowed
himself
to think?
Well, my husband was really quite an innovator. He was an innovator in psychophysical reconstruction. People would come to our home and they'd be bent over like Quasimodo, you know. And he had such finesse and fineness of understanding the psychophysical awareness. We were great friends with Feldenkrais, by the way. And he developed his own technique in which he was able to release the inhibitions in the body so that a person who would come in, you know, bent over after several weeks, they would go dancing out, you know, their spine straightened. He was the only person who ever solved and healed the symptoms of amyotrophic sclerosis, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease. That was one part of him. But he was also an esoteric philosopher. He was very, very, very devoted to the understanding of the mysteries and complexities and philosophies of ancient Egypt. And he was devoted particularly to one of the great archetypes of ancient Egypt, the Sekhmet, the lion-headed goddess who was known as the lady before who, before the time was, before time was, who was a goddess of healing and magic and justified war and of the Egyptian psychologies. And so he, in his mediation of this, he was able to really see very, very, very deeply into the nature, the complexity of the nature of human beings, and thus evoke enormous capacities in people. I miss, you know, he died almost 3 years ago, and I really miss him very much. We were married very happily for 43 years.
Yeah, and quite a kind of creative relationship, feeding off and giving and sharing your collective genius, I think. I mean, one of the other reasons I brought him up was because he was, yes, is into Sekhmet, but he also, I don't know if he channeled Sekhmet, but he was able to open his consciousness to think differently about the nature of reality. And
yes, he was.
And I think that's what we need to do now. And, of course, you do that in your work. But he, it was so extreme, this relationship with this archetype of this Egyptian, that that I think there's a fundamental shift that he, that's initiated in that type of relationship that I think in a way, the planet has to, and human consciousness has to undergo so we can expand the limited notion of ourselves. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes, indeed. And in our, you know, we worked together for many years with many research subjects exploring the depth and breadth of human potential. But as you say, he had a different kind of mind. Now, sometimes that different kind of mind took on some interesting forms. As for example, you know, I did a lot of work in the White House, and Hillary Clinton called him up. Called him my husband and said,
"You got into trouble for doing that."
But this is a funny story. So she calls him up and she says, "Oh, Bob, Bill and I love Jean so much, and she's been such a tremendous help to us, and we'd love to meet you, and I'd like to show you the White House." My husband, who had a very deep voice, said, "Well, I'd like to see the White House. So could you come maybe and we could have a wonderful party in our private quarters, just Bill and I and you and Jean?" My husband said, "I haven't got a suit." She said, "Well, can you get one?" He said, "No." And he hung up on her.
Was he just not impressed by that?
He wasn't impressed by anybody or anything. He was impressed by dogs, you know, and Sekhmet in ancient Egypt. But no, he was just, he was a bit of a hermit, quite frankly. We were complete opposites. We were about 180 degrees. I'm rather extrovertive and very friendly. And he was very introvertive. And, you know, he did not suffer fools gladly. But it was a good combination. I'll tell you another funny story about this.
We would sometimes
be the guests of the Maharaja of you know, Rajapur or wherever, and we would have these people with their great, especially in the East, with their great astrologers want to do our astrology. And so the greatest, you know, state astrologer or the greatest astrologer of Europe would come, and they would do Bob's chart. And the same thing happened all the time. They'd practically fall on their knees. They'd say, "Oh, you are the greatest man of this time. I've never seen a greater chart. You are the number one person. You really rule the world. Oh, I'm so honored to do your chart." Then they would do my chart. And they would say, "Well, all we can say is you're very lucky to be married to such a great man, because I have this nebbish chart." And Bob thought, well, he thought that both of us were triumphs over our chart in one way or another. And that was so funny.
But the reason for all of that, and you, of course, in your work, is how do we start to think differently? I mean, it's in the thinking that the transformation occurs, right?
Let me tell you a story about that. It is true, in the thinking. How do we begin to, you know, not only cross the great divide of otherness, but also cross the great divide of otherness in ourselves, because we have been so habituated by culture, context, expectation, limitations, and do not realize that we are truly the universe in miniature. The latest product of the metabolism of the galaxy, that we have access to universal knowledge, form, dimensionality, understanding. What does it take? And, you know, the human potential is so vast. And then what we can, in certain states of consciousness, really tap into quantum mind and really download, if you will, or at least access the great templates of evolutionary creativity and understanding, so that we have the wherewithal to really make the difference in this world. Now, one of the great ways of doing this, of course, is the entering into different states where we are not bound by these things, or we enter into the fact that we are not schizophrenic, we are polyphrenic, we are not monophrenic, that's a madness, that we have many different personalities, ways of being, knowing. I'll give you an example from my own life. I hate to write. I hate it. I am phobic for writing. But I've written 26 books, and I have 120,000 pages of unpublished material. I have to write a small book every month from my mystery school. Now, what I do is I happen to be a very good cook. Why? Because my mother, Maria Annunziata Serafina Graziella Fiorina Perpetua de Daro, married Jack Houston of Texas. My mother was born in Sicily, Syracuse. Mm. They hated each other's food. to keep each other together, I became, at 8 years old, the world's first fusion cook, making chicken fried polenta. You know, now, I didn't keep them together, but by God, I became a great cook. As a cook, I have absolutely no blocks whatsoever. As a writer, I am completely blocked. So what do? I go into my persona that is the cook persona. I become the cook. I stir in a melange of ideas here, some sprinkling of the seasons of new associations there. And I have no problem because I have shifted an identity to one that has a total belief and my possibility. So what will I do with people? I will give them access to the multiform, polyphrenic, if you will, personalities that they all have, which they can then bring up front and use with a different set of skills, qualities, passion, and possibilities. That's a very...
I still want to get the writing, the cook analogy. So, yeah, you don't like to write and you love to cook. So you make your writing as if you're making a recipe, but you still
More than that, I incarnate the cook. That cook takes over my whole personality.
Well, when you're at the computer with a pen and paper, you still have to write the words on screen or the paper.
That's right, but it's the cook who does it. The cook's sensibility. Obviously, I'm not pouring butter on the computer. But
I know you're not. But I'm just trying to get the sensibility of the mindset that then can actually transfer that skill. Actually, because maybe I need to do it because I'm writing a book that I know if I completed it would change. It would change the destiny of the planet if I could.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, are you having problems with it? I imagine you were if you're going to change the destiny of the planet.
Yes.
Are you having problems finishing it?
Yes, I'm problems. it's like so massive. It's so big, and it's also very simple. I have a hard time? I guess as I sit down and look at the thousands of pages I've already written, I have to then chop and cut and throw away the parts that, you know, that seem so important but not central to the idea.
Have you ever gardened?
I find it a little boring sitting on my knees pulling weeds. But
all right, the only reason I'm asking a gardener.
You know what?
Because the good gardener is an editor, you see. We'd have to find something like a gardener who has that gift of discrimination.
And, you know what I do body work. I like giving massages to people. So it's sort of, I've compared that to gardening. So when I go in and find like a rock here or a dense spot there, I work
on it.
That's
the same thing then. Because what you do as a gardener or as a fine body worker is that you know which patterns to evoke, which parts of the body of the text to leave alone, and which to pull together like a muscle forms again. You become the body worker when you actually do your writing. And you incarnate. You have the mood, the gestures, the sensibilities of the body worker that you then bring to bear upon the script.
I get what you're saying, but with the beauty of body working for me is that I don't think. I let my fingers do the thinking. I'm totally out of my mind, and I feel like when I do sit down to write, I'm very much in my intellect. So what do you suggest there?
Well, you shift. It's a both and plus much, much more. I mean, Stephen King sometimes writes about this, where the writing is a flow. You think of Coleridge writing in the pure state of flow in Xando did, you know, Kublai Khan. Dickens, who had a flow of characters that just flew out of his hands. Enid Blyton, the great English story writer of the earlier part of the 20th century, who wrote some 400 really quite good books. And they asked her, how can you produce so much and it's such quality? And she said, well, what I do is when I write, I put my typewriter on my knee and I put in the paper and then I just wait and I watch and then the little characters, they show up and they sing and they play and they talk and I merely type what I see and and sometimes one of them makes a joke, a jolly good one, and I laugh and laugh and laugh and I write it down. I wonder, who could have thought of that? I couldn't have thought of it in 1,000 years. because what she was allowing was what are called the automatisms of the creative process, the self-creative works of art to really come through. And then it is a flow, and it isn't a thinking on top of, you see.
Right. I think it was Grace Paley or somebody who said, I write in order to find out what I know. So,
that too. Yes.
It's like that. No, I'm sort of getting it. And, of course, this is what your gift is to help people discover the keys to their true purpose. And as you're helping me, I mean, I think I know, I do know what my purpose is. And now, for me, I'm on the stage of activating and living it and having that flow out to the world. And, and that's sort of where I'm at in this moment. And you're saying take something you already are good at, that you do know, that you already love, and apply it to a new situation.
That's right. And it works beautifully in most cases. Are you from New York, Alan? Where are you from?
I'm calling you from my Lower East Side apartment right now.
Oh, for goodness sakes, yeah. So are you a born New Yorker?
I'm born in Brooklyn, yes. Born in Brooklyn, grew up on...
In Brooklyn, pardon me, what neighborhood?
I was born in Bushwick, but then I grew up on Long Island, you know.
I see. That's what I see. I was hearing some of the accent. I was born in Brooklyn, in Shore Road.
On Shore Road?
By mistake, I was a seven-month baby. And normally the Houstons get born in Texas, but my dad, they were living with my mother's parents in the Shore Road section of Brooklyn, so I wasn't there very long, except at 5 years old, I was sent back to go to Catholic school, where I got into lots of trouble for asking the nun if Jesus ever had to go to the bathroom. And I got, 300 million years in purgatory to my credit, and that was the ending of my life in the Catholic Church.
And then you found out that, Jesus was realized his true purpose, basically.
That's right.
You know, the other story,
anyway, go ahead.
No, you have lots of beautiful stories, but the one you told on the seminar I just heard was the one with your father was a writer for Charlie McCarthy, right?
My daddy wrote for Bob Hope, Charlie McCarthy, Edgar Bergen, Burns and Allen, Fred Allen, all those people.
Yeah. Charlie McCarthy or Edgar Bergen comes in and he's talking to his dummy, right?
Yeah, he would talk to his dummy and ask him ultimate questions. What is the nature of life? What does it mean to love? Where is the soul? And the dummy would answer with these brilliant, brilliant, brilliant answers. And Bergen would be so shocked and then ask another great question. And my father, who was standing by and watching, you know, my dad was an agnostic Baptist, and he couldn't stand it. And he said, and he coughed, and Bergen said, oh, hello, Jack. Hi, Jeannie. I was 8 years old. You caught us. And my father said, what in the world are you doing? He said, well, I'm talking to Charlie. His dummy, you know, he's the wisest person I know. And my father says, but that's you, that's your mind coming out of that cockamamie wooden figure's, you know, mouth. And Bergen said, yes, I suppose it is, but you know, when I ask him these questions and he answers, I haven't got the faintest idea what he's going to say. And what he says astounds me with his brilliance. It is so much more than I know. And that was a major point for me, Alan, because I knew that there is just so much more that we contain that we just generally don't have access to, and part of my life is giving people access to this, you know.
Well, this is the same thing. It's the same thing that's been running through this conversation, in a sense, with the woman at the typewriter waiting for the characters to talk, and also what your husband, Robert Masters, would do. I mean, it's this, this theme of this other aspects of us seem to emerge beyond the conscious ego mind, in a sense. That's what we're waiting for to dialogue with, these unseen aspects that hide inside our own psyche and are activated by some kind of a stimulation. And this is what's always changed the world. If you ask any great writer where their ideas come from or where their songs come from, they have no idea, right? So we're here to access the part of us that is a mysterious unknown. It is what the mystery schools are all about, accessing the unknown inside of us.
The great beyond within, that we are a mystery, and part of my work is to school people in their mystery. which is why I've had mystery schools until, though I'm going to close the mystery school finally at the end of this year, at the end of its 28th year. Because I'm working all over the world with Middle Eastern women, you know, empowering them, training them to take the initiatives in their government, and I'm working with Japan and helping in the reconstruction. I just have too many jobs, so I put so much work into the mystery school.
Well, the mystery school has benefited a lot of people, and the mystery will continue. But that's sort of like the place that I sort of want to talk to. So there's the mystery within, and yet you're teaching people to discover their true purpose. So there's something of the conscious mind that thinks it does know what its true purpose is. And then there's the underlying essence of the soul that is emerging as the mystery. And, of course, they can line up. But at some times, we think we want something that we don't. You know?
That's right.
So there can be a little bit of a confusion. How do you get people through that?
Well, there's a whole series of processes and exercises. First of all, they really have to want to find the purpose and destiny. And that I believe everybody has a kind of schlock destiny, a very sub destiny. And then you have an ordinary one, same old, same old. And then you've got also this higher destiny. And so what I've been doing in these virtual courses, which are online now, Awaken to Your True Purpose, Awakening Your Purpose, and then the sequence to that, which is Awakening to Your Supreme, Finding Your Supreme Destiny. People can go and find out about it by going to destinyandyou.com, destinyandyou.com. But what we do is we give exercises that activate the four levels, the sensory and physical, the psychological, the mythic, narrative, and the spiritual. And as you people begin to cook on more burners and then bring this larger mind and this larger template of beingness to bear upon their life, then what happens is not exactly clarity, but energy and passion and images and opportunities and synchronicities and destiny appears, you see. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to just look at destiny or purpose from a narrow niche mind, you're not going to find very much. You're going to find another narrow niche. So we amplify people's capacities and then bring them to bear upon their higher purpose.
I think, you know, that lines up with, in Chinese medicine, they say the lowest form of medicine is to make people well. The second form of medicine is to keep them well. But the highest form of Chinese medicine is to connect people with their purpose, with their destiny. Only when they find their true destiny will they want to be well enough to fulfill that. And so you're helping people achieve optimum health with connecting to their destiny. And part of the other thing I heard today when I was listening to your course is connecting with that embodiment. How did you say it? The embodiment as if we were the master of the craft. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, that's something where I teach people how to use the body of muscular imagination, which is called the sensing body. This is also something that my husband and I worked out together, the kinesthetic body, the body of muscular sensing. And as they develop that body, then they find that they can then take some skill they have, let's say yoga, and they will do it first in the physical body, which is sort of ordinary, and then they do it in the kinesthetic body in a more optimal form, beautifully. They do it beautifully just in the kinesthetic body, so then they're not moving. It's entirely happening in their body-mind, and you can't see any movement. And then I have them play it out in the real body, and they find that they've improved because the pattern, the body of the muscular imagination has trained them to a higher form of excellence. And then I will have them do it.
Just give an example of the kinesthetic. Just go a little bit into like a concrete example of what you mean.
By the kinesthetic? Well, all right. Yeah. Let's say that a person can raise their right arm and raise it above their head and then bring it down. And then they raise it above their head again and down. And then they'll do it again, but not physically, but in their muscular imagination, you see.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and then I will go through different parts of different movements, you know, letting their shoulders make circles and then stop and make circles, stop, and then do it kinesthetically, but they're not actually moving. And then maybe make a fencing lunge to the right and back and forth, and then do it kinesthetically so they're not moving, but it feels as much as if they were actually doing it. And that way, doing a whole series of these things, they develop the muscular sensing so that they are sensing as vividly as if they had actually done it. Well, then, you see, I'll have them do a yoga posture, let's say the hymn to the sun, you know, or, you know, one of the great yoga postures, and they'll do it physically, and then I'll have them stop, and I'll say, now do it beautifully in the muscular imagination, what is called the kinesthetic body. And they do it, and then I will have them do it physically, and they'll find that they've improved. And then I'll say, in your kinesthetic body alone, would you do it as if you were the master of yoga, the master of yoga? And they do it beautifully, that hymn to the sun, and then flow into it physically, and they've improved. And then I will have them do it in their kinesthetic body as if they are the very essence, the very archetype of the yoga itself. And then they do it physically, and they often find very, very rapid improvement in any skill, especially one with a motor, a physical component, that would normally take them many hours or days or even weeks and months to improve. That's one part of the brain, the part of the brain-mind system that is holding the form, the pattern of excellence, which they've seen done, maybe if only on television, but they've seen it done. That then trains the motor cortex, the physical body, very rapidly. And
so
I can do it with almost anything.
That's a beautiful exercise. Thank you for that. I'm actually going to use that in my writing and in every aspect of my life. So ultimately, from this online course that you're doing, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, what is it that you... What do you get out of it, and what do you want people to achieve? I guess first, why are you doing this?
Well, I'm doing it because I'm a nerd. I've always loved computers, that prosthetic extension. And we're in a time of such hyper-connectivity that to extend my work, you know, after traveling sometimes 250,000 miles a year, you get very tired of this. And I rarely travel less than 100,000 miles in a year, you know. And I've done it for so long, and now I find that doing it, doing this kind of training, in through the virtual form, and it's working very well. We know lots of we're getting really hundreds of responses from people who are making tremendous changes in their life by this kind of development. And that's one reason. Another reason, of course, the big one, is that it is time to help as many people as possible to wake up and to begin to live the life that they were meant to live, to explore their capacities and to place them in the world and to help make a difference. And they can as they become more possible humans, you see. It's only the possible human who helps create the possible world. And so I think that's the main reason. And so I'm finding that it's working. I didn't know that it would, but I spend a great deal of time crafting each course, each session of each course, so that the words on the phone and on the through the internet really seem to be evoking people to these higher states of being. So I'm delighted. That's my happiness, to see it actually working.
I think it is working, and like you and a lot of educators and people in the human potential movement are, you know, that's the cavalry coming in and saving the day at the last minute, because, you know, really all we have is our human potential that's going to save this planet.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
And so it's very exciting time. Do you have any predictions for 2012? I know there's a lot of
I really don't. I don't know. I think that there if it results in an activation of higher forms of consciousness, I am all for it. I'm all for it. But I did see a hilarious cartoon about it in the New Yorker some months back, where it's back in the ancient Mayan times, and you see the Mayan pyramid in the background, and two Mayan gents, and one is rolling a big, big stone calendar. And he says, "I ran out of stone when I got to 2012. And the other gent says, "Boy, that's going to freak them out someday."
Right, I saw that too. Any thoughts on extraterrestrials and how that their consciousness interacts? Or I believe they exist.
Well, I think that, you know, obviously we live in a highly populated universe. You know, it would be really a terribly dull universe out of, what is it, 300 sextillion stars in our universe alone that we would have in 190 billion galaxies have been found so far, that we were the only ones. I think that we're visited. I think that, you know, in not too far along, we'll probably join the galactic milieu in helping develop planets, you know. But I suspect, I mean, I've been in the crop circles, and I find them fascinating and incredibly beautiful, and perhaps they are messages. But I think that perhaps we're coming to the time, as I'm sure you believe, that we're going to really join a much larger universe and be invited in, perhaps.
Absolutely. And I go on the kind of biology of Bruce Lipton, who says we go from the one to the many to the one to the many. As cells came together, they formed a unity of one multicellular creature, and these creatures came together and they form a singularity of community. So as the Earth, and this is Winston's idea, forms the singularity as a unity of consciousness, then we will then meet other singularities openly. I mean, so we can form the next level.
So. Hopefully that is so.
But,
it would be a great blessing.
It's
so
coming.
My course, they can go to destinyandyou.com, and it's not to sign up for the course, but to hear, get a free download of me talking about the course and what it will be.
And that's a great download. I listened to that. It's about 120 minutes or something like that, and it was beautiful, and you really see how much effort and energy and passion you put into this course. So I recommend it. I recommend people.
Thank you so much, Alan. I appreciate that.
I've been talking to Dr. Jean Houston, really the grand dame of the human potential movement, I would call you that, and social philosopher, researcher, author of The Possible Human, which was a great book. And the website, again, is purposeanddestiny.net. It actually shows up .net here. And you can
or purposeanddestiny.net or destinyandyou.com.
Thank you
so much, Alan, for having me. What a delightful conversation. What a great evocateur you are.
Well, I think I'd love to sit down with you on my television studio when you're in New York next time.
All right. Okay? We'll do that.
Okay, lots of love, and I'm very happy you're out there doing what you're doing.
And you too, Alan. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to leave with this song called The Song of the Soul, Chris Williamson.
Chris Williamson, I remember it well.
You know that song, The Song of the Soul?
Very well. I've used it in many workshops. Yeah. I'm going to have to leave before the song is over, but thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Thanks again. This is New Realities with Alan Steinfeld. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com, or email me at newrealities@earthling.net. Thanks for listening.
Can be happy. The light will heal you, and you can feel you. Sing out.